thank you very much. I'm with Defending Rights in Dissent, and I'm covering the trial today for Jacobin. And I was at the court-martial of Chelsea Manning, where I joined a number of people, I don't know how many years ago it was, where we took Obama's Nobel Prize and laid it on the gates of Fort Meade, saying Obama should give his Nobel Prize to Chelsea Manning, who has done more for peace than he had. This is the most important. The reason why I am still here 14 years later isn't just because the US and the UK governments will not stop persecuting WikiLeaks. It's because this is the most important press freedom trial of the 21st century, not just for my country, where the stake of the First Amendment is on the line, but for the world. Julian Assange is not an American. WikiLeaks is not an American publication, but the US government says they can come and find you anywhere in the world and put you on trial for exposing their war crimes. If that precedent is set, it will be the death of journalism in the U.S., it will be the death of journalism the world over, and it will be the death of all of our rights to say no to war and militarism. We have to remember that when the collateral murder video came out, when the Iraq and Afghan war logs were released, many people were disturbed by how the corporate media had cheerleaded on the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and WikiLeaks was a breath of fresh air reminding us what critical journalism that spoke truth to power was. Here we are 14 years later, and the media is once again cheering on more wars, a genocide in Gaza, bombing in Yemen, maybe another Iraq war, who knows? From the very beginning, the U.S. government knew that you can destroy journalism by destroying the sources. The imprisonment of Chelsea Manning, the attacks on Edward Snowden and Daniel Hale have always been part of a backdoor war on journalism. Now they are going through the front door and trying to lock away the journalist himself, and we cannot allow that to happen. Thank you very much.
Our boy Chip Gibbons there from Defending Rights and Dissent. Eloquent speaker, very proud to have had Chip on this program. Seeing him out there like that, putting it very directly and succinctly, I think, what's at stake with the Julian Assange case.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll be talking about that a little bit in just a moment. But welcome everybody, Left Reckoning 158. Free Assange and can the UAW win the South? I'm David Griscom, joined as always by Matt Leck. And in a little bit, we're going to be joined by our good friends at the Valley Labor Report to talk a bit about Southern labor and the UAW strategy there. Always such a treat having our good friends from Alabama on the program. And don't forget, friends, you can join us after the show in the postgame, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to all of that. But yeah, Matt, I mean, we're going to talk about this Julian Assange trial a bit. And, you know, there's an aspect to this, and we've been covering this. I mean, Matt, I mean, you know, we've been covering this since we've known each other, right? And this obviously preceded, but even when before Matt and I knew each other and I started working with Michael, Matt started working with Michael. But this is, you know, what Chip was saying in that clip there is not hyperbole. I mean, this is one of the most important cases when it comes to press freedom, to democracy. And it's frightening to see the way that it's still continued to be held in the shadows. The misinformation that is out there. And frankly, some of the lack of seriousness in the way that this issue is treated. Maybe just to start up, I don't know if you've seen this, Matt. This was tweeted out by Stella Assange, Assange's wife, and WikiLeaks. A pretty shocking clip here from CNN, just in the amount of ignorance that we're still getting in the American media. Let me just play this for a second. And I'm truly like this is truly amazing here that basic facts of the case are still being missed. But anyways, let's play.
What is Assange's argument for not being extradited to the U.S.?
There are several. One of them at the most basic level is that he has some mental health issues and a concern that he may take his life if he's move to the US to face trial. Another is that this is politically motivated. He was just a journalist doing his job, so it would breach his human rights if he was transferred to the US. Quite extraordinary claim now coming in, just in the last hour or so, that his lawyers have presented to the court. Obviously, we need to investigate this further, but this is always all presented in open court. According to Assange's lawyer, there is compelling evidence now in existence that senior CIA and US administration officials requested a detailed set of plans and drawings of the embassy, the Ecuadorian embassy, you'll remember he was holed up in for all of that time. And they are suggesting that President Trump at the time himself requested options, and sketches were even drawn up. When we're talking about options, the legal team is basically suggesting that there was evidence of a CIA plot to kidnap or assassinate Julian Assange. These are extraordinary claims.
Well, there are a lot of new details coming out. And again, those accusations have to be verified and looked through.
Wow. Extraordinary new claims. Matt, you look a little puzzled here. I mean,
famously, Hillary Clinton was quoted jokingly saying, can't we just drone the motherfucker or something like that? Now, that suggests to me some sort of impulse toward action of some sort. But I also just say, again, the most basic thing to mention here is the legal situation, which is that it has nothing to do with Assange, honestly, or even the press freedom thing. It's that the UK is committed to, here's this. UK will refuse to extradition if there is a risk that the individual's human rights will be violated in the requesting country. Obviously, that is going to happen to Julian Assange. That's how America has been treated all of the whistleblowers, both associated with this and not. I mean, that America cannot be trusted to uphold the rights of people like this. So, like, it should be open and shut.
Well, and absolutely, and I think that the importance of this in that sense is absolutely critical. But let's not miss something there, because some folks might miss something. At the end of that clip, they talk about this new evidence that has just dropped from Julian Assange's lawyers that the Trump administration and the CIA were getting information about the Ecuadorian embassy, and that they were drawing up plans to assassinate Julian Assange. This isn't new information. Look right here. The Guardian, CIA officials under Trump discuss assassinating Julian Assange report, right. First repeated by Yahoo News. If you've been watching Left Reckoning for the past few years, we've had Chip Gibbons on talking about this time and time again, the attempts by the United States government to harass, spy on Julian Assange.
Including going as far as going through
Julian Assange's children's diapers, trying to to get genetic information about his children. This is from El País, from 2020. Spanish firm that spied on Julian Assange tried to find out if he fathered a child at the Ecuadorian embassy, and this goes through this deep operation. With connections to the United States government on spying on Julian Assange, in the most intimate way possible, right? So, I mean, look, I want to talk about the Assange case, but it's just like, this is a really important aspect of it, is one, what Julian Assange has done is shown time and time again how much of a need there is for serious journalism when it comes to the American government. Let's just hold it at that for a second. And two, how willing and ignorant major players in the American corporate media are on a whole host of subjects, including this one, where you are covering the Julian Assange case, and you are now surprised by major international stories that have just come out. This isn't a 15-year-old story. This is a couple years ago that you don't even know enough background here to be able to talk or write about this. It's truly, truly absurd to live in a country that, we had 4 years of Trump as president, and what was the narrative in this country? Oh, press freedom is under attack. Democracy will die if there's no press freedom. All this kind of stuff. And look, I'm all for fighting for journalists' right to be able to publish information. And here you are watching an attempt that is now a unity between Obama, Joe Biden, and Trump to torture a journalist, Julian Assange, a very clear threat to press freedom. And you don't even know enough to be able to report on it accurately. It's something else.
Max Foster, I'm just trying to get this guy's name here, because look, I mean, ignorance is one thing. And there was a guy on MSNBC who referred to the Nakba and said, you know, this is really strongly contested whether people were expelled from their homes. And, you know, he later apologized. And I think that did come from ignorance, despite the guy being, you know, 10 years older than myself anyway. I think there is a lot of ignorance. I also think at a certain point, we have to understand that places like CNN, and again, this isn't to say everyone at these places. I think there are a lot of journalists that are doing, are generally motivated by the good thing, even I think most people at most of these organizations. But at the very top, making a lot of decisions are people who are, if not assets to the CIA or American Empire, they have fucking lunch with them all the time. And so CNN and shit like that, like, I mean, it is wild, and it shouldn't be lost on people. And it is one of the things that is worth reiterating, how much the American media or the Western press in general dined out on these leaks and cover themselves in glory, because this is what everyone expects from the media, is this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then now you have these same organizations, and which isn't to say that they were all doing so great even when these revelations were made. A lot of them were calling him a terrorist at the same time, right? But you know, yeah, again, to this sort of referring to him as if like, oh yeah, he claims he has got some mental health. Imagine saying that about somebody who faces a possibility of solitary confinement. Yeah.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
Like, that's called a human rights. Human rights are supposedly important to his mental health.
To be held in, I mean, could you imagine to be held in the custody of a foreign government? You know, and I think you just have to make this point explicitly clear for people. Julian Assange is not an American citizen. Right. He did not conduct business in America. WikiLeaks is not an American media company. So this is a foreigner that the United States is trying to extradite into America. I mean, could you imagine for a second if, like, Iran was trying to extradite people from the United States for the government to torture them because of things that they didn't like that they published? You know, I mean, you know, I'm not trying to do, like, all this whataboutism, but, like, let's be really clear about what this is. It is such a night and day case. And, you know, every time we talk about Assange, I hope it's getting better. I don't always know if it will. You'll get somebody who gets really worked up because their favorite person didn't win the presidential election in 2016. And they're like, oh, well, he sort of deserves it because he published information that was embarrassing to Hillary Clinton in 2016, which, full stop, that is an absolutely disgusting position to take, right? To say that, like, hey, if you publish embarrassing information about a presidential candidate that I like, I think that the United States government should be able to torture you, right? So that's disgusting enough. So I already would attack that. But let's also be very clear that what he is being tried for, what he is being, what they're trying to extradite Assange to the United States for, to torture him for, is for publishing true examples of American war crimes in the disastrous American adventurism in the Middle East, right? That is what they are coming at him for, not Hillary Clinton versus Trump or whatever there. They're coming at him because he exposed American war crimes that truly shocked the conscience of the American people, and rightfully so. You know, and I hope that this is getting better. I worry that the Julian Assange case has been going on for so long, you know, that there might be a little bit of exhaustion, but you cannot allow yourself to get tired of the story because it is ongoing. And we're watching somebody fight for their very life here with massive consequences for human rights, for democracy, for journalism, not just for Americans, but for people all across the globe.
Yeah. And I mean, it's shocking to see journalists attend something that directly, threatens the actual job they're supposed to be doing and either not recognize it or blow right through it because they have other priorities.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think maybe in closing, I know we played this at the top, but it's worth highlighting our good friend, Chip Gibbons, who has been a guest on this program many, many times, you know, was at the extradition case on behalf of Jackman Magazine and gave this speech outside. And we played the full version up there. People should watch the whole thing. But here's just a snippet that I think is really powerful and important to note.
It's because this is the most important press freedom trial of the 21st century, not just for my country, where the stake of the First Amendment is on the line, but for the world. Julian Assange is not an American. WikiLeaks is not an American publication. But the U.S. government says they can come and find you anywhere in the world and put you on trial for exposing their war crimes. If that precedent is set, it will be the death of journalism in the U.S. It will be the death of journalism the world over, and it will be the death of all of our rights to say no to war and militarism. We have to remember that when the collateral murder video came out, when the Iraq and Afghan war logs were released, many people were disturbed by how the corporate media had cheerleaded on the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And WikiLeaks was a breath of fresh air, reminding us what critical journalism that spoke truth to power was. Here we are for
I mean, there's a reason you'll see someone like you saw somebody like Daniel Ellsberg so active in this, who represented that to a different generation. The answer is clear, and it is a shame that people, and it's wild to me that so many people want to be blinded by immediate partisanship to miss such a significant threat to, I mean, a way of life that, I mean, you want to call it American or call it post-enlightenment, whatever the fuck. It's a threat to a way of life that we should cherish. And you said it.
Yeah. And let's, you know, be very clear here what the legacy of the Democratic Party and Joe Biden's administration has been, particularly when it comes to international affairs. It's bear hugging Netanyahu as he pursues a genocide in Gaza. And it is bringing journalists, the foreign journalists to the United States to be tortured for exposing war crimes. That's the policy of the current government who's asking for your vote in November. Folks.
I was going to say, yeah, since Assange, I don't remember exactly when the Assange thing happened, but there's been three terms of Democrat and one term of Republican in the office, just to, you
know, all been very pretty brutal when it comes to press freedom. But folks, let's jump over, switch gears a little bit to a more positive and exciting story. We're going to be joined by our good friends.
Well,
I guess, you know, a little up and down.
The first half is positive. Yeah, the second half is maybe a little bit more macabre and more,
you know, I don't know. Maybe it's just because I went for a jog before recording the show. But it's like there's something about, like, even some of the difficult things that we talk about towards the end of this interview. It's like there's something about facing up with your enemy and just sort of say, all right, I know what's in front of us. We got to tackle it. That is, like, I don't know, optimistic and exciting for me. But maybe I'm just losing my mind. We're going to have our good friend from Alabama at the Valley Labor Report join us. Hope you all enjoy it. There are links below for people to follow all of their work. You definitely should be tuning into their program if you aren't already. But without further ado, let's talk a little Southern labor with our good friends from Alabama. Welcome back, Left Reckoners. David here, joined as always by Matt Leck. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing well. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you, and good to be with our guests, our good friends Jacob and Adam from the excellent show, The Valley Labor Report. How are y'all doing today? Oh, you're quiet, Jacob. You got your mute button on.
I'm doing great, brothers. I don't know about Jacob. Obviously, he's struggling a little bit, but I'm doing great. Happy to be here. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm doing great. Appreciate it. Glad to be here.
I just want to say they are, despite Jacob's audio problems, actually legit radio guys. not even just like us YouTubers and patron podcasters, full on getting on the airwaves. So yeah, it's very good to be with Jacob and Adam.
I don't know if David, if this is what made you think about getting us on the program, but we just got on a fourth radio station this week. Oh, hell yeah. We are making our debut on WMMT, the bluegrass giant in the mountains in Whitesburg, Kentucky, this week. So, yeah.
Hell yeah. Oh,
so it's not WMMT for modern monetary theory. It's for
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, they're like, it's like progressive bluegrass community radio. So maybe there was like, when they were picking the call sign, it could be, but so
that's awesome.
I don't know.
Congratulations.
Four stations across three states. So
damn.
That's very cool.
I mean, I really love I love listening to y'all's program, and I love what you're doing. And I love hearing what y'all think. And you know, I think this is, I feel like, a kind of news story that I think all four of us get really excited about when you get to talk about Southern labor directly. We love talking about labor, but it's very good when we're talking about the South. You know, so, you know, all of us have been talking a lot about the UAW, this incredible strike, the leadership of Sean Fain. And I think one of the things that's the most exciting about what we've seen from the UAW has been, like, you know, like, if Sean Fain wanted to go and hang out in Mexico for a couple months and, you know, have a margarita sit at the beach, you know, I wouldn't judge him for it. But I mean, almost immediately after this incredible victory for the UAW, we've seen, you know, this real push to expand labor-ship in the UAW, sorry, membership in the UAW. And most notably, I mean, where they're looking to expand is in the South. So I was wondering, I mean, maybe just to start, if y'all could give our listeners who might not have been following this, just a kind of general sense of what this push is, what the strategy is, and, you know, how it's looking right now.
So basically, like you said, I mean, there was no rest. Sean Fain and the UAW immediately turned around after, winning really good contracts at the big three automakers. They turned around and immediately began a genuinely historic attempt to organize the non-union auto sector, which is very, concentrated in the South. So they're targeting 13 non-union automakers, a total of 150,000 workers, and they're doing it just really, really differently than what you have seen most unions when they try to organize in place in an industry. They will try to pick a target that they feel like, one single plant that they feel like will be really, you know, really favorable, easy. They'll start slow. They'll try to build a committee, and they won't let, you know, they'll try to keep it under wraps until they feel like they're really strong, and then they'll try to go for it. And that makes sense, I think. And I think that that's, you know, just generally speaking, all else being equal, that's a good strategy to have. But the gamble that the UAW is making is that this is a unique time in American history as it relates to labor and working people, and that the working class is ready to organize, and they just need people to let them do it. And so that's the gamble that they're making. So they have, you know, publicly told 13, you know, huge multinational global corporations, we're coming for you. And we have, you know, hundreds, thousands of your employees are already signing cards. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's a totally different kind of strategy. And it seems like it's been paying off so far. So we're going to see how it goes. But they have hit 30% at three manufacturing facilities right now, two in Alabama and one in Tennessee. And they just hit 50% at the Volkswagen plant in Tennessee. And basically the reason that it's been going well is because, at least at these facilities, what the UAW bet on was right. There are people there that are interested in organizing, and they just needed the space and the opportunity to do it. And so they have empowered the folks on the ground in these places to organize, with, you know, under the cover of the UAW. And, you know, it's absolutely, huge.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you want to add to that, Adam? Or
yeah, I mean, I think it's worth noting that this was probably the biggest organizing drive in the South since, like, mm-hmm. Operation Dixie, right after World War II. It's hard to come up with a comparison, and so that's historic in its own right, regardless of how this shakes out. But I mm-hmm. think Jacob's right that there is a lot of momentum, and it's been interesting to see, you know, the worker-led organizing, right? The workers at Mercedes in Tuscaloosa, you know, pushed demands on the UAW about how they wanted this campaign to go. And, you know, the UAW has worked with them and supported them and, you know, and is kind of facilitating it, right? And I think we have some issues sometimes with labor unions who third party themselves, right? And don't always empower the membership. And ultimately, I think that's where your strength lies. And so I think that could be part of the success we're seeing. Maybe we'll get into the political aspect here in a moment, because we're definitely seeing some reaction from the political class in Alabama.
Well, I mean, I definitely want to get there, but just for some folks who might not know, I think this is actually an important thing to note. What do you mean there by third-partying themselves, Adam?
So anti-union forces a lot of times will portray the union as a third party, as this outside entity, right? That the union is coming in to do A, B, and C, when really the union is the workers, right? It's the members. But sometimes I think you have folks in union positions, whether it's, you know, high up elected office or staff roles, who sometimes play into that caricature and sometimes play into that role. And, you know, will I think be a little, you know, they will impress upon the members how they want the campaign to run, how they want bargaining to run, you know, and kind of boss them around, for lack of a better term. And I think that does happen. We have to be real in our movement that's something that's a phenomenon that we have to deal with, right? And not everybody appreciates that. And, you know, that's sometimes difficult for folks to do as like straight up partisans of the labor movement like we are. We're rank and file activists, we're elected leaders, we've committed our lives to growing this labor movement here in the South in particular. But, you know, we do have to be honest about the shortcomings. And you know, this isn't the first time UAW has tried to organize in Alabama or Tennessee. And we've had quite a string of failures before. So, it's worth highlighting the historic nature of it and the aspects of success that we're already seeing that seems to point in the right direction, that something's different this time around compared to years ago.
I have a question on that, you know, for you know, two guys who cover this closely. Let's say somebody went into a Rip Van Winkle style coma 2 decades ago. What would you, there's a lot of things you could emphasize as far as like what's changed, but I'm curious, like what would come to the top of your mind? Jacob, if you want to go first, and Adam, you can go again.
I mean, one reason that's difficult for me to kind of answer is because I was not kind of politically conscious 2 decades ago. But, you know, from being somewhat, you know, politically conscious a decade ago and then having read some about what life was like 2 decades ago, you know, I think that there are, you know, there are really contradictory forces at work right now, and if you were to explain it to somebody from 20 years ago, it might not even make sense. And so one thing that you would say, especially if this was like a numbers person, right? In 2023, there has never been a lower percentage of the working class in America that are members of unions. So you hear that. And then, you know, the person from 2 decades ago is going to be like, ah, well, shit, everything is just terrible. It's all gotten worse and there's nothing, you know, like, and it's also worth kind of trying to grapple with that, because we know that there are at least a lot of good media narratives and there are good signs, but we do have to grapple with that fact, right? I mean, there's great headlines, there are great stories, there are great testimonies, there are great signs, but the fact remains that in 2023, there has never in American history since we began keeping data a lower percentage of American workers who are members of unions, right? And so that's one thing that you would tell them. But then the other thing you would say is that unions have never had a higher approval rating since we've been having these polls and taking that data. And I think that you would have to explain some of the dynamics as far as, you know, the pandemic really kind of changing a lot of people's understanding about work and labor and how much power and you know, realizing how much power or how little power they have in society and their workplace and not being content with that. I think that also, you know, several years of a pretty tight labor market on top of that rupture of discontent from the pandemic has, I think, kind of awakened people and emboldened them to take steps maybe that they, or at least to think about taking steps that they wouldn't have before. And they see in the labor movement, it's like the symbol of people standing up and taking advantage of the power that they have in this moment. And then obviously you would have to talk about the UAW and saying, you know, yes, it's true that, you know, we've never had fewer union members as a percentage of the working class. But right now we have the most serious attempt to change it since what somebody 2 decades ago would have seen in the 1990s with the new voices in the AFL-CIO and Lane Kirkland and all of those people, because they would have actually just hit the peak of another wave of union reform, right? I mean, new voices in the AFL, the Teamsters with Ron Carey, and it, you know, I mean, it failed ultimately, right? They were not able to turn the tide. And you would be able to talk to them about how those reform efforts were really more top down than what we're seeing today. You know, Lane Kirkland and the new voices in the AFL, they were like staffers, and there wasn't really a groundswell from the rank and file to support these reforms and to make sure that they followed through on them. And this time there is, you know, there were a lot of good people in the 90s that were trying to do what they could, but they just didn't have the groundswell of support. And right now, you know, that's kind of the difference I think that we're seeing in the Teamsters and the UAW is that there's the rank and file are pushing these reforms, which is definitely different. And I think probably is a reason that we're seeing more results than we did in the 90s.
Yeah, I don't think you can really overstate the fact that, so much of this reform movement is coming from grassroots. Or, you know, I almost don't like using the word grassroots because it makes it seem like it's not like organized, but it's like coming from the bottom up, right?
Yeah.
It's real work from everyday members. Go ahead.
It seems to me like kind of like what we see in politics, and it's probably not unrelated to, you know, we have the great financial crisis, and you seem to have like a more, maybe an electoral savior with Barack Obama there. And we also all saw that really not really deliver on that thing. So people are seeing like, well, how else can I be empowered? Right. And, you know, you have obviously Occupy during that time. But yeah, I that's interesting.
Adam, I'm interested in Adam's thoughts on that, because I think Adam was more, at least more than I was aware of kind of what the feelings were politically and around unions 2 decades ago or 15 years ago. I mean, what would you say to that?
Yeah, there's a couple of things y'all said that really stood out. I mean, I think the emphasis on the Democratic rank and file reform movements is really, you know, important. And Matt, to your point, I think there has been a wave, you know, like wave after wave of, you know, I hate to use the term awakening, but experiences that people have had from the recession to, yeah, the disappointment of Obama, to the Occupy Wall Street experience, to the Black Lives Matter uprisings, you know, the Bernie campaigns. And a lot of these same people are now labor union activists, right? People who kind of cut their teeth organizing in those capacities. And so that's, I think, part of it. I mean, there is a militant layer of working class activists and organizers that are out there that are pushing this labor movement to live up to its promises and live up to its potential. But in terms of, you know, 20 years ago, I can only speak for myself growing up in the South. You know, we never heard about unions really. my first exposure to unions was like on ESPN, hearing about the baseball players and football players and stuff. You know, it wasn't part of the, you know, it wasn't part of the political consciousness really. And if, you know, if you heard anything about it, it wasn't going to be good. And so I think certainly in popular consciousness, there is a change now, even if, you know, it is, like Jacob said, set against this really grim fact that we're as unorganized now as we've ever been, or at least, you know, in this modern era. And so, you know, one thing I want to emphasize in terms of what's what could we say about 20 years ago is that 20 years ago, auto workers in Alabama actually made more than they do now, right? There has been an actual, like, real decline, not just in wages, but also in working conditions and just the general quality of these jobs, right? And these jobs were sold as great jobs, as, like, you know, saviors to Alabama's economy, right? And so I think that's also, you know, just to get into like a real practical thing of 20 years ago, that's important, right? People's working conditions, their wages, their benefits, their overall material conditions declining at a time when you see record profits, right? And so that contrast, I think, is also something that's feeding into this organizing wave as well.
Yeah, that's definitely got to be part of it. I think it's in some industries it's not as acute as it has been in the auto industry in Alabama, but just to put, you know, 11% less is what the average auto worker in Alabama makes today, compared to 20 years ago, 11% less. And Alabama auto workers already made, you know, back then 10 to 15% less than auto workers in the rest of the country. You know, I mean, that was the whole deal, right? Is that, you know, you get a discount when you come to Alabama. And so the idea that Alabama auto workers are now making even less in real dollars is really, something that has to be reckoned with when you're talking about the feeling of particularly those people. But even that saying, you know, in 2019 dollars, 20 years ago, auto workers in Alabama made $75,000 a year. Today they make $64,000. Well, that doesn't even really do justice to people coming in now, right? Mm. Because back then you didn't have tiers. And so when you go in to work for an auto, at an auto manufacturing plant today, you're not making, you know, if I were to go and get a job today, I wouldn't be making $64,000 a year. I would go in as a second tier employee, or as a temporary employee. As a temporary employee, your pay can be, I mean, typically, 50 to 60% of the people that are doing the same job right beside you. Maybe then you get hired on as a permanent employee in the second tier, where you can eventually make up to 80% of what people are making, doing the same job right next to you. And that's like the top. And there's no opportunity for you as a new auto worker to get into the first tier, right? That's just a permanent division in the workforce, right? So even saying they make 11% less does not capture like the reality on the ground for people who are coming in today. And, you know, talking to folks at Mercedes, their anecdotes and their testimonies are really acutely, speak to that, because I spoke to folks who have been there actually since the Mercedes plant opened, the first auto plant in Alabama. There are people involved in the organizing campaign that were there the year that it started. And they talked about how it was so difficult to get a job on back then, And, you know, you had to know somebody, and it was just like everybody wanted to work there, because it was, you know, you were making less than an auto worker in the rest of the country, but you were making a lot more than anybody else without a college degree in Alabama, right? I mean, that was just a fact. And today, he said, they can't keep anybody because it's not better than other jobs in Alabama. In fact, it's like really bad because the pay is basically the same, and then you've got the terrible schedules and you don't get as much time off and all this kind of stuff. So
And, you know, and I would, you know, in addition to checking out y'all's program, you know, I would also check out like the UAW social feed has had, you know, some really, you know, powerful and very well highlighting pieces about what, you know, people's experiences is from like the hard work to like things like favoritism, you know, getting passed up on jobs that you should get hired for, right? There's just so much visible injustice that, you know, I think, you know, you should have a lot of, you know, ability to be able to reach folks. And, you know, you'd think, you know, politicians would sort of recognize, you know, there might be an opportunity to fight for everyday people in Alabama or in Tennessee, you know, and maybe get some kind of political credit from the vast majority of the population. But is that the kind of calculus that we've been seeing from politicians in Alabama so far?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the politicians in Alabama are conservatives and they're Republicans, and so they love working families. And so they have been all in favor of this, and they say you should make more money. No, actually, that's not what we've been seeing, unfortunately. And so we're seeing.
Well, sorry, not to cut you off, but just like the brief history lesson. When these plants were coming to Alabama, I mean, were these Republican officials in power at the time?
No,
not entirely. I mean, no, yeah. I mean it's worth noting that, you know, Alabama didn't become a solid Republican state until 2010 during that Tea Party wave, and. That's similar to a lot of southern states, right, where you had these blue dog Democrats. Conservatives were in charge, right? Make no mistake about it. It's just they were team blue.
The politics have always been the same, more or less, for the last, you know, I don't know, 100 years in Alabama.
I mean,
there's the parties have changed.
Yeah, there's obviously been moments of upsurge and change. But yeah, it's something about the, you know, in terms of bringing that industry here, you mentioned this, Jacob, about the discount. I think that's, you know, we have to acknowledge that's kind of the whole point here, right? Is the automakers were fleeing union states up north, and they wanted to come down to Alabama where they had a cheaper workforce, you know, a more exploitable workforce because of a lack of protections, and they would benefit from hostility to unions from the government and the political class. And obviously, that's got a long history in this state, a long, ugly and violent history in this state of the political and business class aligning against unionization. And we're seeing, you know, the wealthy, powerful elites and the political folks in Montgomery, they're doing the same thing this year or, you know, with this campaign. And we've seen them come out swinging against this auto worker organizing. I mean, calling the UAW an outside special interest while defending multinational corporations, right? Mercedes and Hyundai. Last I checked, not Alabama companies, right? But you know, the gall to say that the UAW is the outside interest, right? Yeah, you can pick it up from there, Jacob, but, you know, I just wanted to point that out, that about the political aspect of it, that, you know, this is the economic development model of the South, really, is to promise non-union, cheaper wages, generous tax handouts, and, right, we're going to use the public treasury to subsidize these industries, which we have to over $1 billion of the auto industry in Alabama over these 20 years. So, you know, that's the model that they've pitched, and this poses a threat to that model. And they are, you know, sort of putting that out there that, hey, remember, this is why they came here. So if you organize a union, will they stay? Will you lose that job? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the implicit threat, I think, behind a lot of this.
Yeah, well, David, you were muted earlier when you said something, so I don't know
just agreeing very much with what Adam was saying, and I realized I was muted. Anyway,
well, that is the funniest thing in their anti-union campaign is that they're calling the UAW an out-of-state special interest group. You know, like Adam said, as they're defending Hyundai and Toyota, you know.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, I don't want to support too much like jingoism or anything like that, right? But it is amazing to see anybody sit around. Yeah.
Literally out of states, out of the states, special interests. I mean, just it is the funniest thing that you should feel more, you know, patriotic kinship with like Japanese ownership than a Michigan auto worker. You know what I mean? That's like, that's the argument that they're making implicitly there. It's just incredibly funny. But the other arguments are as I see it, there are kind of four arguments. One of them that Adam didn't touch on was basically that you don't deserve more. Saying that in all of these articles that they're writing, and it's, I mean, really is a full court press. The governor's coming out. The commerce secretary is coming out against it. The president of the Business Council of Alabama is coming out against it. And the BCA is saying that they are going to be taking out radio ads. They're going to be producing newsletters and newspapers and doing programs and just, you know, a whole propaganda war on the UAW. And one of the things is that you don't deserve better. You are highly paid and highly skilled, actually, and your life is good and your job is fine. So, you know, sit down and shut up. The other two arguments are that, like Adam said, you'll lose these jobs if you organize, and then raising the specter of Detroit, which are kind of, you know, they're pretty related. And we spoke about that on the show a couple of weeks ago. The specter of Detroit, you know, the argument there is that it's the UAW's fault that the American auto industry was destroyed. And it's just not, you know, because they were too greedy, right? Because the workers were too greedy. They asked for too much and they were paid too much. And it's just difficult to, you know, square that with the actual reality of the UAW because they took concessionary contracts for the last 40 years, right, up until 2023. And then on top of taking concessionary contracts this entire time, there have also arose recently corruption scandals in the past, you know, 10 years or so. And so you've got to believe that, like, And the corruption was the companies were bribing union officials for, you know, special treatment or you know, for you know, backroom deals. And so to believe that the UAW was so greedy that they put the auto industry out of business, you've got to believe that the companies were bribing the UAW presidents to take too much money from them. You know, I mean, if you follow the logic there, it just doesn't, it really, you cannot square it with reality, with the facts, with history. But that's what they're trying to do. And then obviously in 2008, you know, I mean, the UAW sacrificed more than probably any group of folks in the country to save the American auto industry and the American economy. And then, you know, losing your job, the factories leaving is kind of related to that argument. But now we can look just to a couple of months ago where the UAW was able to get a contract with Stellantis that committed them to reopening an idled facility. That's something that has never been done in the history of American manufacturing, as far as I'm aware. A union forcing the reopening of an indefinitely idled manufacturing facility by the same company.
And I mean, I'll just say, like, capitalists in my experience, like covering these things, don't like giving precedence like that. Like letting things like that get started.
Exactly. And so, you know, when and I have used that a lot, you know, I mean, I go on a conservative radio program every Tuesday morning. And so that's something that he has constantly been saying. Oh, well, they came here because, you know, we're non-union. And so if we become unionized, then they're all going to leave. And I'm like, so isn't it going to be a job killer? And I was like, well, actually, you know, you look at UAW's strike in 2023. They created thousands of jobs. Actually, they reopened an idle plant and they got a commitment to build a new parts distribution facility and an electric battery plant on the same campus, right? And so you can actually say, you know, look, the union created jobs and the union drove investment and the union put the workers in the driver's seat for these, you know, for these investment decisions and product placement and stuff like that. And they also won, importantly, the right to strike over plant closures and investment decisions and product placements. And so that is a completely different dynamic than you would have been able to point to even just a year ago, right? Because that hadn't been done before. And another thing that's really great about the reopening of the Belvedere plant in Illinois by Stellantis is that the like almost 1,000, it's like 800 something workers are being paid 75% of their wage until the plant is reopened. So, you know, that is huge. That is absolutely enormous that you've got people that are laid off, that are the company is taking care of them. Not because the company wants to take care of them, because the union made them, right? Mm-hmm. It's just super easy to dispel those arguments and say, you know, that is why we got the auto industry here in Alabama to a large extent, but it doesn't have to be that way. The road to the, the race to the bottom, it's not, set in stone that has to be the way our economy functions. Our economy can function by having workers in the driver's seat, or at least a hand on the wheel, keeping the capitalist from, you know, running us off of a cliff. And that's the way that, you know, I think it should be. And I think when you talk to people about that, even conservative workers in Alabama, you know, you say, I think that you should have some say over, you know, what the company that you sacrifice 30 years of your life to, right? I don't think that that company should be able to up and leave with zero ramifications and without your say and input and your coworkers' say and input, right? And that's not, you know, in a certain way, you could say that's a radical idea, but when you put it like that, it's really not. It's like, you know, you gave 30 years of your life, or you're going to give 30 years of your life to this place. So they, they forfeit some of their right to do whatever the hell they want.
It shouldn't be. It's radical to say human dignity is relatively the same everywhere. And that this whole idea where we're going to sell basically depressed labor to people as if it's going to remain like that way forever is, you know, it's inhuman. But what do they care? They're just looking for like a little contracts for a little bit until they can either squeeze people or try to move somewhere else. But go ahead, Jacob.
Do y'all remember free speech zones back in the Bush era? It is funny how, like, in America, like, we talk so much about democracy, but we sort of have, like, you know, democracy areas or democracy-free areas, and, like, that's work, right? And then saying anything about how that should be run is super dangerous and radical. So we only got a couple of minutes left, and, you know, folks, we're going to be watching this, story really, really closely. You know, everything that's going on with the UAW is really exciting, and I'll tell y'all that, like, seeing a revived labor movement really picking up steam in the South, I think, is massive for the country and our politics. But just briefly, because, you know, this is a kind of, this will be an ongoing story as well. Since we have y'all, I want to get y'all's reaction, to this attempt from three companies, frankly, that really do represent some of, like, the true evils of 21st century capitalism, which is SpaceX, Trader Joe's, and Amazon, who are arguing now that the National Labor Relations Board is unconstitutional. Maybe I'll start with you, Adam. You know, I'm just curious, you know, your kind of general thoughts and feelings, what you think this means, how worried people should be. You know, I'm not going to make you predict the future, but I'm curious what you think here. What's your reaction?
Yeah, I'm concerned about it. And I think we all should be concerned about it, honestly. I think it's just another reminder that class war is real, right? The ruling class will always try to take and take and take and push and push and push. And we all know, you know, if you're listening to this show, you probably have a pretty good sense that the current labor law in this country is totally tilted towards employers. It is totally broken for working people. It's not working. And that's part of the reason why we have such low union density today, because of the stuff that companies can get away with. So it's not ideal by any means. But the idea that we're going to actually make it worse. I can't help but think, you know, that this is, we are in an era of Gilded Age level inequality, We're seeing a return of child labor. We're seeing a return of convict lease labor. You know, all we need is Elon Musk to start wearing a top hat and a monocle, right? And just to complete the robber baron vibes that we have.
Well, he's bringing
on.
Back like the race science too.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's like we're going through, you know, the Gilded Age again. We're going through the 1920s again. It's pretty scary. And so I think that, you know, I by no means am a lawyer. I haven't studied the case closely. But I think the assumption, you know, that we were talking about before we went on the air, that this will happen, right? The Supreme Court will rule against us and will, you know, it, in some form or fashion, demolish the National Labor Relations Board. I think that's a realistic possibility, if not, you know, the most likely outcome, given the dynamics in our courts, given the, you know, the trends, given how they rule against workers. I think we have to, at the very least, be prepared that that is a very likely outcome. And so the question is, the so-called leaders of our labor movement, where are they and what will they do about this, right? How will we respond? And, you know, so I'm curious about how leadership will respond, how the institutions will respond, but also how will we respond from the bottom up? Ultimately, that's where I think change comes from. And as we've talked about with the rank and file insurgency to really reform these unions, you know, how will everyday working people respond if our rights to legally organize are completely defanged? You know, and it is, I think, a situation where we can look at the New Deal and this system of labor laws as a sort of compromise. I think you can acknowledge that it was in some sense, right? The workers didn't get the means of production. So in that sense, it's a compromise, I would argue. But it brought a form of labor peace, and it certainly brought some degree of worker power that was, you know, steadily eroded over the decades. You know, what will happen if that sort of regime is totally, you know, upset? I don't know. I really don't know. I think it will force all of us to really build a movement. I mean, I think that's the only thing we can do, is to build a mass working class movement, an interracial movement, a movement that can really transform this country. And I think that's what we need, particularly here in the South. You know, it's not that I want that to happen. I don't think, hopefully no sane person wants this to happen. But we have to operate with the assumption that it very well could, and we have to be prepared and be organizing, and how will we respond, you know? And that brings up a lot of questions strategically. It brings up short-term and long-term questions of how do we proceed? Because if the way we've been doing things for, what, 70, 80 years is suddenly ripped to shreds, we better get our shit together.
Mm-hmm. Jacob?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have much to add to that. Just to echo all of that, you know, I think that it would be very detrimental to have the National Labor Relations Board stripped from workers, having that institution at least nominally be some sort of referee between capital and labor, because, you know, if you read about, you know, the history of labor before the NLRA, I mean, it was violent and bloody, and in none of those situations where it became violent and bloody, or in almost none of them, did the workers come out on top, because, you know, if you're talking about violent confrontations, you know, unions and working people and even organized groups of working people, just, you know, the violent power of the state is a lot more, you know, is a lot more than the violent power that workers have, you know, as a class, or at least than we have been willing to show. And so it's a very scary prospect, but I think that the way to prepare for that is to do what the UAW is doing, is to do what, you know, unions across the country are doing, and organizing and building more power, building strength, you know, internal organizing, making sure people are educated, not necessarily about their rights, but about where their power comes from, which is, you know, their numbers and mm-hmm. their solidarity, and their willingness to strike and withhold withhold their labor power, which is what, you know, creates all the profits for the people at the top.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, one way to at least keep in touch with what's going on, particularly in the South, is to be tuning into the Value of Labor report each week. Could y'all tell people who might not know where to find y'all's program?
Yeah. So, like we said, just before we started, we just debuted in Kentucky on WMMT 88.7 FM, Whitesburg, Kentucky. We're on in New Orleans, 102.3 WHIV. We're on in Huntsville, 92.5 WVNN, and in Muscle Shoals, I think 1450 AM, something like that. It's all at different times, the recording plays, but you can find us online anytime on Facebook and YouTube at The Valley Labor Report, wherever you get your podcasts. This Saturday, I'm really excited because we are having on Daniel Letwin. He wrote The Challenge of Interracial Unionism, Alabama Coal Miners, 1878 to 1921. And it is a fascinating read because, unlike in a lot of other industries and in a lot of other places in the country, the organization of Alabama's coal miners has always been interracial. And that has been complicated, and there's been contradictions. But it's remarkable how black and white coal miners in Alabama in 1880, 1890, in 1901, as Alabama's constitution was being rewritten by revanchist redeemers. I mean, literally, while that was happening, the UMWA was interracially organizing in coal mines in Alabama. Like, you know, I mean, it's just what they were doing, you know. And so that's a really inspiring story. I mean, the things that they were able to win from that was kind of minimal, just because, you know, like I just mentioned, you know, the violent power of the state was very much used in Alabama in the 1880s and 1890s and 1900s. But the solidarity that those workers had for each other, you know, taking into account all the contradictions and all the complications, is really, really inspiring and really cool. So super excited to have that conversation.
Well, hell yeah. And it's always such a pleasure to speak with y'all both. Thanks again for hanging with us on Left Reckoning. We'll put links below for people to find the episode. Y'all be checking them out on Saturdays on YouTube and on the radio. Thanks y'all again.
Yep. Hey, thanks, brother. Appreciate you.
Always nice hanging out with our friends there. Please do check out the Value of Labor Report if you haven't already. I love the strategy of getting out there on terrestrial radio. It's actually something that we should be doing way more of.
I mean, honestly, it's a sort of thing where it's like, damn, I think, sorry, like, damn, like, I wish, like, every time we have them on, even from the very first time I heard about them, I'm like, that's a very good idea, and they're the only ones still doing it. <It's>, you know.
Well, yeah, it takes some work.
Thanks doing it. Do it.
Talking about that, folks, I think that might be enough show for this evening. But wait, it's not over. We'll be heading over to the postgame, patreon.com/leftreckoning, where I know Matt has been cooking up something really nice for us.
So, yeah, we don't have a primary on any side this year, and that's a big problem for us content creators in the politics sphere. That was an easy harvest, and now it's gone. So we're going to be looking back at 2016 at a moment where Lil Marco attacked Donald Trump over his labor practices in a way that was right on the money. And Trump's, we'll look back at the way Trump sort of jumped in and look at some history, and it, this regards Trump, the Trump Tower. And I sometimes think it's forgotten the place that the Trump Tower had in culture. Even like, I think I'm probably too young for it. Like, I was born in 1988. Trump Tower opened 1983, but for the 80s, that was like the, that was like shorthand for like, look at these new buildings of like the super rich can create, right? Turned out it was created with undocumented labor, and it had Trump testifying in court under oath that he didn't know what off the books meant, which is a pretty funny thing.
No idea. That's accurate. No,
what? What is he saying, this off the books? I don't know. Off the books? Is it, what is it on TV? I don't know. But yeah, so patreon.com/leftreckoning. We'll get into that.
Yes, folks. So come over there, join us, hang out a little bit, support the show. Patreon.com/leftreckoning really helps us out. Before we go, you know, just a little bit of a heads up. Your boy's getting married pretty soon. So we're going to take, we got a show coming out next week. We're going to take a short break after that. So just a little programming note, we're going to be taking a quick vacation, but we'll be back very, very soon, folks. Yeah. Why don't you help support the show and help me get my life started down here?
We might do some Twitch streams. I might do some Twitch streams, I should say, in the meantime. So
just running out of my honeymoon.
Raise David money for the boat ride.
All right, folks, we're going over the post game. Patreon.com/leftreckoning to join us. See you there, and take care, friends.
Peace.